Gracious Father, we thank you so much again, Lord. As we begin our third and final leg with Alan, we just thank you for his wonderful teaching and everything that he's edifying us with, Lord. And we just ask that you would keep using Alan in an incredibly and powerful way. God, that we want to thank you for him blessing us and giving us all this knowledge and wisdom, Lord. And Father, more than anything, we just pray that we are able to apply these things to our lives, Lord. A lot of these things that we're introduced is very challenging to us. And some of it may even go against our very character, Lord. But we know that you call us to uncomfortable situations and you cause us to grow and stretch. So God, I ask that you would expand our minds and our hearts, that we may have the propensity to love as you call us to love. That we may have the heart and the wisdom to reach all the lost, Lord, not just the lost that look like us. God, may we be a blessing to others. And Father, as we finish out tonight, Father, truly give us the ears to hear, Lord, that we may truly understand, especially in this truth and compassion of whatever world lecture, Lord. We thank you for your blessings. We love you, Father, for all these things. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's give Alan a round of applause.
So I think in about 1 hour, the Los Angeles Lakers are coming up to play the Golden State Warriors, right?
Yes. Yeah,
so. I thought you used to be a Lakers fan as well, too.
Yeah. I was a season ticket holder.
You were a season ticket holder. Okay. Oh, that's better than me. All right. Well, we are going to change subjects quite significantly now from yesterday's topic about homosexuality and today's topic on same-sex marriage to a much broader subject, and that's the subject of relativism. And in the 20th century, Christians and Christianity was viewed as simply an irrational belief. Christians were thought of as, you know, stupid or foolish people. And that's what it was like in the 20th century. However, we have now entered into the 21st century, and things have changed. Christianity is not only irrational, but we are immoral and we are dangerous. They say we are immoral because we are judgmental. We say certain behaviors like abortion or homosexuality or embryonic stem cell research are sinful things. And by saying such actions are sinful or wrong, we are deemed as immoral for making such judgmental statements. We are perceived as dangerous because we teach exclusivism. This is the idea that we think our view is correct, and therefore... Now you might say, well, I'm not a radical Christian, but just so you know, what she means is any Christian who actually believes what the Bible teaches and tries to live it out consistently. So, yes, you guys would fall under the definition of a radical Christian because you actually take Jesus at his word. Amen. Bill Maher, who also is a well-known talk show host today, he's got a political show called, I think, Real News with Bill Maher or something like that. Real Time with Bill Maher, yeah, on HBO. He said this, organized religion, that would be Christianity, is dangerous and a mass psychosis. Evangelical Christians are usually the ones behind everything that represents intolerance and bigotry. And again, don't be distracted by the term evangelical Christians, because he doesn't know what that means. He just thinks any Christian who takes their faith seriously. So that would again include you as well. And Andrew Sullivan, who I also quoted earlier in the previous lecture, said this, religion and religious certainty, meaning being certain that your religion is true, that's the problem. When the presidents of the United States and of Iran speak as much about God as about diplomacy, we have entered a new dangerous era. Notice, these people think we are immoral, psychotic, and dangerous. So the question I want to ask is, are they right? Is it true? Is Christianity immoral and dangerous? Now, of course, the culture generally thinks that's the case, but the reason why they think this is because they have adopted a philosophy called relativism. They've adopted a philosophy called relativism, and it's the most common form of thinking today in our culture that leads people to believe these ideas about Christianity. And so in order for me to explain to you how relativism works, you have to understand two kinds of ways that something can be true. Two kinds of ways that something can be true. And the only way I can really explain this is by sharing something that is deep and personal to me, something that has affected me in one of the most profound ways in my entire life. And that thing is ice cream. I love ice cream. And in fact, I believe that Häagen-Dazs chocolate peanut butter ice cream is the best ice cream around. Okay? Now, is there anybody here that has a personal favorite flavor of ice cream that is different than my personal favorite? Yes, you here in the orange shirt. What's your personal favorite flavor of ice cream?
Matcha with strawberry.
What was it called?
Matcha?
Oh, matcha tea. Oh, with strawberry. Okay, matcha with strawberry. Okay. So let me ask you a question. Would it make any sense for me to say that he's wrong about his personal favorite flavor of ice cream? No, it doesn't make any sense. Why does it not make sense? Somebody's been reading the notes. Okay, why is it wrong? Why does it not make sense for me to say he's wrong about that? Okay, it is subjective, but what? Yeah, that's true. That's the answer. But what does that mean? What in everyday words? What does it mean? It's an opinion, right? Right. When it comes to personal favorite flavors of ice cream, you just pick what you like. Okay, you like matcha with strawberry. I like chocolate peanut butter. Okay. You can like your flavor, whatever, you know, and I can like mine, okay? Now, and we're both correct. So when he says matcha with strawberry is my favorite flavor of ice cream, that statement is true when he says it. But if I was to say the same statement, matcha is my favorite flavor of ice cream, it would not be true. That same statement would be false. And the reason is because this is what we call as you were mentioning, a subjective truth claim. And it's called a subjective truth claim because notice the word subject is in there. The truth claim is about me or him. It's about us. We are the subjects and we are expressing our own personal preference. Okay? And so when it comes to a subjective truth claim, it can be true and false at the same time, depending on who is making the statement. So conversely, if I say chocolate peanut butter ice cream is the best ice cream, it's true when I say it, but if he says it, it's false. And that's okay. Subjective truth claims can be true and false at the same time, depending on who's saying it. Now, if you had a condition known as diabetes, and you had to go to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, in order for you to help control your diabetes, you need to take insulin. Insulin's a medicine that will help you control your diabetes. Okay, so your doctor makes this proclamation. And you say to your doctor, well, doc, I appreciate your encouraging me to be healthy, and I'm sure you have a good medical degree, I'm sure you're really smart and intelligent, but to tell you the truth, I'm not sure that's really going to help me as much. I think if I just ate some pound cake, it'll help my diabetes just as well. Okay? This might be true for you, doctor, but it's not true for me. Okay? That's true for you, but not for me. Now, would it make sense to say that? No, why not? Right, it's objective. So the difference is that when you're making a claim about external reality, when you're making an objective truth claim, the statement is either true or false. If it's true, it's true for everyone. If it's false for everyone. Okay? Because this is not a statement about his preference or my preference. It's about what's out there in the world, this thing, insulin. And this thing, insulin, either helps diabetes or it doesn't. It doesn't matter what I like. It doesn't matter what he likes. It doesn't matter what anybody likes. No one in the world could know anything about diabetes or insulin, and it wouldn't change the fact that insulin is a medicine that helps control diabetes. because this is an objective truth claim. It's not a subjective truth claim. It's about an object. It's not about the subject and our personal preference. It's about some external reality. Now, relativism, at its core, treats everything like ice cream. Relativism treats everything, all truth claims, as if they're subjective ice cream types of claims. You just choose what you like. You might like this, I might like that. We're both right. There is no right and wrong. Everyone's true. You are the arbiter of what is true. And so relativism makes truth relative to the subject, not to the object. And it treats everything, whether it's religion or morality, as if it's a matter of picking your favorite flavor of ice cream. So let me do a quick review before we take a test. Okay, you didn't know this test was going to be issued upon you today, but the pastor will be taking note of the results and factoring that into your membership status. Okay, so please pay attention here to what we're going to review. All right. So subjective truth claims. These are claims about a subject, me or someone else or you. Right. It's an expression of our own preference. Whereas objective truth claims are a claim about an object. And please don't think like physical object. I just mean anything external to a subject. So it could be an idea, it could be a principle, it could be a physical object, right? But it's something external from a person. Subjective truth claims can be true and false at the same time. Whereas objective truth claims cannot be true and false at the same time. They're either true or they're false, right? For everyone. Subjective truth claims, the truth or falsehood depends upon a person's preference, right? Because remember, they're an expression of preference. Whereas objective truth claims, it doesn't matter what a person's preference is. You could hate insulin all you want, it's not going to make it cease to be a medicine that helps with diabetes. Subjective truth claims cannot be tested. You know, you don't have to test whether he likes matcha strawberry, right? You just ask him, what do you like? He says that, and you're like, whatever, you know, who likes that flavor? No, I'm kidding. You can like it, right? But objective truth claims can be tested. If I was to tell you there is an elephant in the parking lot of your church right now, we can test this claim because it's an objective claim, okay? And we can all go outside and look, is there an elephant there? Say, no, Alan has lost his mind, okay? So we would test it. And so even though my claim that there's an elephant in the parking lot, is that claim true or false? False. Even though it's a false claim, it is still an objective claim, okay? So even though the statement's false, it's still an objective claim because we can test it. And we can go and see and investigate. An example of a subjective truth claim might be this. I love to watch the TV show America's Got Talent. Okay? An example of an objective truth claim is Mount Everest is 29,029 feet high. Actually, I think it grows every year a few inches, but you get the idea. There's only one height of Mount Everest. So that's the review. Now I'm going to perform a test, okay? What I'm going to do is I'm going to say a number of different statements. And I want you to evaluate, is Alan making a subjective truth claim or an objective truth claim? If I state a subjective truth claim, I want you to say out loud, ice cream. If I say an objective truth claim, I want you to say out loud, insulin. Does that make sense? Okay. Please be aware, the church pastor and leadership is paying attention to your answers. Okay. All right. And they... you will get a letter in the mail notifying you of your current attendance. All right, here's the first one. Disneyland has 79 rides. Okay, yes, insulin. Very correct, right? So, now... you might not know whether Disneyland has 79 rides or not. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. To tell you the truth, I don't even know. It doesn't matter, right? Because it's either true, it has 79 rides, or it's false, it doesn't, right? And whether we like it or not has nothing to do with it, because it has nothing to do with our preference, okay? So you're right, it's an insulin claim. How about this? I like Toyota more than Nissan.
Ice cream.
Yeah, ice cream, right? So, I mean, it's not saying Toyota makes better cars or Nissan has longer, you know, value to their car. It doesn't say anything about that, okay? It's certainly a personal preference, right? How about this? Alan, me, I can bench press 315 pounds.
Insulin.
Insulin, that's correct. It is, it's an objective truth claim. We could test it. Like, we could get a bench right here, put 315 pounds on it, and we can see if I could actually bench that much. By the way, this is actually true. Yeah. I might look like I'm thin and scrawny, but if I flex my muscles right now, they'll tear right out of my shirt, you know. But because we're at a church, I want to be modest, you know. I don't want to embarrass the other men here. I can't bench 315 pounds. All right, how about this? The chairs in this room feel comfortable. Well, he's confident, and he's right, okay? Does anybody think it's insulin? No. It's an ice cream claim, right? He might think it's comfortable, but maybe he might think, no, my bottom is sore, my back hurts. These are not comfortable, okay? All right, so notice a lot of these are very trivial matters, right? They're just about Disneyland, cars, whatever. That's no big deal. But let's change the nature of the claims now and see what you think. How about this? Slavery is wrong. Ice cream or insulin?
Ice cream.
You want to guess again? Slavery is wrong. Is this a claim about reality or is it a claim about slavery itself? Okay. Well, if you asked a person who's a flat earther, is the earth flat? Would that change the shape of the earth simply because there are people who disagree about something? At one point, people debated whether the earth was flat or round, correct? At that point, was there an objective reality about the shape of the earth? Yes. The earth has always been round. So just because there's people who might disagree with what they think is true doesn't change the nature of the claim, right? So let me ask you again. Is slavery wrong, an ice cream, or an insulin type of claim? It's an insulin claim. Think about it, okay? I'm not saying I like slavery or I prefer slavery to be legal. I'm saying slavery, that thing out there in the world external to me, I'm claiming it is wrong. Now, you might disagree with me, in which case my statement that slavery is wrong would be false. But if I'm correct, the statement slavery is wrong would be true. So that makes it an objective truth claim. It makes it an insulin type of claim. All right? Because remember, it's not an expression of my preference. If I wanted it to be that, I could say, I prefer slavery to be legal. Now it's an ice cream claim. But I'm not. I'm claiming slavery, this thing, is wrong. I'm claiming that human beings are the type of people that cannot be owned. Now, we could debate that. We could look at science. We could look at philosophy. We could look at theology and discuss and debate it and figure out, is it true? Is it true that slavery is wrong, or is it true that slavery is permissible? But the fact that we can debate and determine what's correct is a testament to the fact that this is an insulin type of claim. See, we have been conditioned by our culture to think that when it comes to matters about morality, we can't have any knowledge about them. We think that it just comes down to personal preference. And this is why the church we live, at least the American church, lives in a culture that is completely saturated with relativism. And although we have no problem saying this is true or false, you might not know, we might disagree. Some of you might say, oh yeah, Alan's muscles look huge, he could do it. Some of you might say, no, there's no way he could do it. Well, look, we disagree with it, but you know that that's an insolent claim. And the same would be true here. Yeah, we might disagree about whether it's right or wrong, but the fact is, it's not a claim about my preference or yours. It's a claim about an external reality. That's why it's insolent. How about this? God does not exist. Insulin or ice cream? No, why do you say it's insulin? That was so quick, y'all. Is it because you learned from the... Yeah, it is an insulin claim. Now, think with me. Do we think that statement is true or false? False. Okay. Are there other people in the world that think it's true? Yeah. So there's people who disagree about that, right? So how come you didn't say it's ice cream then? Because we learned, yeah. Because it's a quick learner, right? Because it's a claim about God. The question is there something out there in the universe called God that exists or not? Now the statement says, there is no God. Now that statement is either true or false. If there is a God, that statement is false. If there is no God, that statement is true. So again, it's a statement about external reality. It's not an expression of a person's personal preference. Okay? And that's why, yeah, it's an insolent claim, even if it's false. The Bible is my favorite book. Okay, ice cream, correct. Yes, it's a personal preference. No. Jesus is the only way to God, and so therefore Jews and Muslims are mistaken.
That's a good one. Insulin.
Okay, why do you think it's insulin? That is what the Bible teaches, but that's not why it's an insulin claim. It's talking about Jesus, right? The claim is about the nature of Jesus. Okay? So Jesus is an external reality. Now he's either the Son of God and the Messiah, or he's not. Okay. Now, there's people who disagree with us on that, and we disagree with them on that. But again, it's a claim about something external to our own personal preference. And that's why it is an insulin type of claim. Okay? It's not,
that's all I say about it. That's just the case, right?
How about this one? Abortion is wrong. That's right. Abortion is insulin, right? Now, even if there is an abortion choice advocate standing on the stage with me right here, and he or she is a champion of abortion, they would agree that that statement, abortion is wrong, is an insulin claim. Now, they would disagree with it, and we would say, well, why do you disagree? We might have a debate, okay? But the fact that we can debate about the truth or falsehood of it is a testament to the idea that it is an insulin type of claim. Right. So this is very interesting, right? You see how even within the church, we're influenced to think that we cannot have, that we can't even claim that the nature of Jesus or about God existing or slavery or morality can be things that can be objectively discussed as being true or false. We think they're all just personal preferences, okay? And that's the problem. People in our culture, in America, think that when it comes to morality and when it comes to religion, these are claims like ice cream claims, not insulin claims. People think when it comes to morality and religion, it's all about your own personal preference, and that's it. There is no state of affairs out there which we can determine is incorrect or correct. So, when it comes to morality and religion, you just pick what you like. You like mate? No, jeez, I keep forgetting. Matcha. Matcha strawberry? I like chocolate peanut butter. You like Jesus? I like Muhammad. Well, I mean, it's all it is. That's how they perceive this thing. They think when it comes to morality and religion, there are only subjective truth claims, not objective truth claims. In fact, Alan Bloom, in his really well-known book, The Closing of the American Mind, said this about the subject. He says, there is one thing a professor can be absolutely sure of. Almost every student entering the university believes, or says he believes, that truth is relative, meaning it's all about subjective truth claims. The students, of course, cannot defend their their opinion. It is something with which they have been indoctrinated. And as you can see, the idea of relativism is not just prevalent in secular culture, but even in churches, which, like, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to fault you guys, we all have been influenced by it. And I would say one area where we don't even realize it is in our biblical interpretation. Because many times when we're asked about what a Bible passage means, you might get three or four people give a different opinion, and the facilitator of the Bible study says, okay, great, we've all heard different people's ideas of what this verse means, let's move on. Well, wait a minute. Not everybody's interpretation of a Bible verse can be correct. Right? The Holy Spirit, as he inspired Paul or whoever author, intended one meaning. And we can't, if we guess the incorrect meaning, then we're wrong. But even when it comes to biblical interpretation, many of us have adopted a relativistic approach to interpretation. Now, I'm not saying a verse can't have different applications. I'm talking about meaning. What does a verse mean? That's a single thing. Now, there was a very well-known book based on research by a guy named Christian Smith. The book is called, it's called Soul Searching. And he looked at American youth and even Christian American youth to evaluate where they stood on the question of relativism. And he said that American youth, like American adults, are nearly without exception profoundly individualistic. The typical bywords are, who am I to judge? Or, if that's what they choose, whatever. Or, each person decides for himself what's true. Or, if it works for them, fine. And so as a result, we have a tremendous amount of relativism when it comes to the nature of religion. So for example, there was asked, what percentage of conservative Protestant teens affirm there's only one religion that's true? Okay, so conservative Protestant teens, it was 46%. So less than half of conservative Protestant teens thought that there's only one religion true. Most of them thought, no, there's multiple religions are true. When they asked mainline Protestant teens, mainline would be like Episcopalian, United Methodist, PCUSA, so on and so forth. These were like Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, Baptist, Church of Christ, kind of the more conservative ones, right? But when they asked mainline, it was only 26%. It's even worse, okay? So again, 75% of mainline Protestant teens think, oh no, multiple religions are true. Christianity isn't the only true religion. When it came to morality, similar kind of problem. Now this is non-Christians. So 22% of non-Christian adults say that moral truth is objective. In other words, less than a quarter of adults think that there is some objective standard of morals that we have to live by. Right? And of course, they're not Christians. They don't probably believe in God, or maybe they believe in God, but don't think that he's got moral standards for them. So that's why it was so low. Teens, only 6%. I mean, that's really, really pathetic, of course, right? But these are non-Christians. You'd expect that Christians would be better about believing there is a moral standard out there that we have to live by. And they are better, but not much better. 34% of Christian adults said moral truth is objective. 34%. I mean, that's horrible. It's one-third of Christian adults think that there is some standard of morals out there that is objective that they are bound to live by. And that standard does not change. Only a third said that's the case. And of course, with Christian teens, it was horrible, just 9%. Okay? This is a Barna study done. I don't know how familiar you are with Barna, but Barna does a lot of polling and research. We have friends that work at Barna and, you know, just really troubled by this. The point is this, the church cannot adopt relativism and expect to suffer no ill effects. Because ideas have consequences. And bad ideas have, what? Victims, right? That's the problem. And so, maybe you heard of this phrase, or maybe you didn't, but there's a phrase in German, it's called Lebensinvertes Leben. It means life unworthy of life. It was a phrase that was part of the Third Reich in World War II. And it was the idea that there are some people who don't deserve to live. And because of that thinking, 6 million or so Jews were killed, exterminated, experimented on, right? That was the idea that was justified the Holocaust. So what are the consequences of this bad idea of relativism? Well, there's a couple I'll just mention. The first is this. Relativism completely undermines sin and consequently undermines the gospel. Now, why is that? How does it do that? Well, think about this. How do we know that sin is real? Well, as Christians, we know sin is real because we believe there is a God out there, right? God is an objective reality, exists whether we like it or not, okay? And God has a standard of morality. He has a way that we're supposed to live, right? Okay? We would call that objective morality. And so when we do something wrong that violates the standard, we are then found to be in sin. And if we're in sin, then we are guilty. And if we're guilty, the only way to get out of that situation is to be pardoned. And how do we get pardoned in Christianity? Through the gospel, through Jesus, right? So that's how it works, right? Now, if the church, though, adopts relativism, what does relativism say about objective morality? Are morals something that exists out there that dictate how we should live? No. So relativism completely erases objective morals because now what's right and wrong is just up to me or up to you. Or you might say cheating on tests is wrong, but I think it's okay. You know, you might say cheating on your spouse is wrong, but I think it's okay. Right? So morals are just relative to each person. And so if relativism is true, there is no objective morality. And therefore, if we haven't committed any behaviors that violate that morality, then there is no sin. And if we haven't committed sin, then we're not guilty. And if we're not guilty, there's no need for a pardon. And if there's no need for a pardon, well, then there's no need for Jesus either. This is why relativism undermines the gospel. This is why I say ideas have consequences. In Judges, the book of Judges, as you probably know, is the story of Israel and their, following God at first, but then they kind of deviate from that practice, and then God sends a judge, and then eventually Israel calls out upon God and repents, and they kind of go through this cycle over and over, right, of that. The very last verse in the book of Judges that nicely summarizes what happened is this. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's moral relativism, right? Because when there's no king in Israel, there's no standard of how to live. And if there's no God with an objective moral standpoint, there's no morals, there's no standard by how which we would live. Like C.S. Lewis, in his book, Mere Christianity, made a very important observation. He said this, "It is after you realized that there is a moral law and a power, meaning God, behind that law, and that you have broken the law and put yourself wrong with that power, it is after this, and not a moment sooner, that Christianity begins to talk." Right? If we're not guilty for committing any crimes and accountable to a God who's going to punish us, who cares about Jesus? There's no message of the gospel. It's totally irrelevant. I'm fine. Why do I need Jesus? Why do I got to, submit my life to Him and trust Him? It's only after you realize there is a moral law. And that, of course, by definition, disqualifies relativism as being relevant. So that's the first consequence. Here's the second consequence. Relativism completely undermines mission. Because think about it, Jesus said in Matthew 28:19, go and make disciples of all nations, baptize in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them all that I've commanded, right? But if relativism is true, and there isn't one true religion, if Christianity isn't the only true religion, then what's the point of going out into the world and telling people about the gospel? Why? You go to some country like India, just let them pick whatever religion they like. Go to China, if they got a religion there, pick whatever religion they like. Go to Africa, any country there. I mean, why impose your religion when it's not the only religion? Any religion can work. Right? And, you know, there are many different religions, and again, relativism treats these different religions like favorite flavors of ice cream. You just pick what you like. And so there's no motivation for evangelism. Why go make disciples of all nations? So that's what relativism is. That's the consequences. Let me now offer you a tactic that I use in everyday conversations that will help you to demonstrate what's wrong with relativism and how it applies to the Christian faith. Okay? This tactic is called taking the roof off. Now, for those of you who might know Latin, it's called reductio ad absurdum. Does anybody know what this means? What does reductio ad absurdum mean? Got any people studying classical education? What does it sound like it means? Reductio ad absurdum. Reduce to the craziness. That's pretty close. Reductio ad absurdum literally means reduce to the absurd. Okay? So this is our name at Stand to Reason, we give it taking the roof off because it's easier to understand, excuse me. But basically, this is a standard logical principle that can be used in any kind of situation, all right? And this tactic really basically capitalizes on the fact that some views have absurd consequences. So the way the tactic works is you kind of accept the person's rationale or thinking just for the moment and see if it leads to some ridiculous, absurd conclusion. And if it does, then you can reject the rationale that led to that particular conclusion. So let me unpack that in three steps, and then I'll show you some examples of what it looks like. Okay? So here's the first step in this tactic. First, you've got to adopt the other person's view. So you know how sometimes you might say something like this. You might say, hey, you know, for sake of argument, let's just say you're right. You know how we sometimes will do that? So that's what you want to do. So just for sake of argument, let's just say you're right. So we're adopting the other person's view. Then here's the second step and the key step. You take their idea, assume it's true, and take it for a test drive. See what logically follows from their rationale. See if their rationale leads to some absurd or ridiculous conclusion. If it does, then the third step is to ask a question that graciously exposes the absurdity of the view. Now, I believe you all already know this tactic and have used it before in your life. Okay? Even though you might be saying, I don't understand what you're talking about, Alan. Let me prove it to you, okay? Imagine a hypothetical conversation between a father and his daughter. And the daughter has just started to smoke. And the father comes up to his daughter and says, honey, why did you start smoking? And she says, well, because all my friends were doing it. Now, what's the father going to say in response? That's right. If your friends all jumped off a cliff, would you do that too? Okay? That makes total logic sense. So what the father just did is he took the roof off. He just did a reductio ad absurdum. Notice, the first step in the tactic is to adopt the person's view. So the father says, let me see, what is my daughter's view? She said she started smoking because all her friends were doing it. Okay, so that means if her friends do something, then she's going to do it too. Okay, so let's now take that rationale for a test drive. Let's follow it to its logical conclusion. Well, that would mean if her friends jumped off a cliff, she'd jump off a cliff. That's absurd! That's right. So is the rationale that she gave him. So then he asks a question that demonstrates how her rationale leads to the absurd conclusion. So all he did was he took the roof off. He just did reductio ad absurdum. Jesus even used this tactic with many of the people who opposed him. Here's an example in Matthew 12. Where Jesus has just healed a person who was possessed by a demon. And then remember the Pharisees, and everybody was all against Jesus. So here's what happens. The Pharisees heard about Jesus exercising this demon out, and they said, "This man Jesus, he's just casting out demons only by Beelzebub, the ruler of the demons." And Jesus, knowing their thoughts, said to them, "Wait a minute. Any kingdom divided against itself is laid waste, and any city or house divided against itself shall not stand. And if Satan is casting out Satan, how then, he is divided against himself, how then shall his kingdom stand?" So notice Jesus, taking the roof off tactic. He says, let me first just accept their rationale. They think I'm basically the ruler of the demons, and I'm casting out other demons that are on my side. Okay, let's see. Let's follow that to its logical conclusion. That would mean that Satan is divided against himself, but if that was the case, his entire kingdom would be destroyed. Like take, for example, an army of tanks. You got an army of tanks. They're going to take out the enemy. But instead of taking out the enemy, the army of tanks turns on itself and starts to shoot at itself. Now, is this army going to survive or be destroyed? Be destroyed! Because the other army would be like, "Well, you just did our work for us, right?" So Jesus makes the same point. He's like, if I'm Satan and I'm casting out other demons, my entire kingdom will be destroyed. But Satan's kingdom is not destroyed. See how absurd your view is? So therefore, so is the rationale that led to the absurdity. See, even Jesus went to our website and learned this tactic and used it effectively with the Pharisees. I'm kidding. It wasn't Jesus. It was Peter who went to the website. But so let's take a look at a couple of examples of things that I've heard recently on university campuses. Okay? And let's just see if we can take the roof off with some just obvious examples. Okay? How about the first one? "I can't believe the Bible because it was written by men." Now, can anyone think of a question that graciously takes the roof off of that particular objection? Well, first, before we do that, let me ask you, what's the rationale that they are suggesting? Yeah, if something is written by men, they are not going to believe it. Okay, can anyone think of a question that shows the absurdity of that rationale? What's that? Yeah, the history textbook is written by men. Oh, so therefore I can't believe that. The Constitution is written by men. I guess I can't believe that. Charles Darwin, The Origin of Species, was written by men. I guess I can't believe that. You know, the DMV manual, the dictionary. I mean, it's like, this is absurd. That's right. And so is the rationale that led to the absurdity. How about this? I was born with a kind of a natural tendency to be gay, so therefore being gay is, normal or permitted. What's the rationale being offered here? What's the thinking? What was that? What's the rationale here? Yeah, if you're born with a tendency, then what? It's okay. All right? Can anyone think of a question that graciously takes the roof off?
My son and daughter.
Your son and daughter what?
They always go at it, and they fight each other.
Okay.
Is it okay then if my son doesn't like my daughter,
right, yeah, so my son has a natural tendency to beat up on his daughter, on my daughter, okay? Does that make that okay? No. It's a perfect example. By the way, it's also a gracious example, and I say that because sometimes Christians will give this example. They'll say, "Well, what if I was born with a tendency to molest kids, Would that make that okay?" Now, although that takes the roof off, you know what happens is when you say that, that inadvertently communicates that you think homosexuality is equated with molestation. And even though you're not saying that, that's what they hear. So that's why I say, find an example that doesn't use such an over-the-top, taking-the-roof-off approach. Another one that I will use sometimes is this. I have a natural tendency to lie when I get myself into trouble. Would that make lying okay? No, of course not. Okay, so just because you have a natural tendency towards something doesn't make it okay. Okay, so we don't have to keep going through all of these, but I just wanted to give you a couple of examples. Well, this is the other one. Since we talked about homosexuality, this is Rosie O'Donnell, by the way, said this. Homosexuality has been observed in animals, so therefore it's natural and normal. Okay. Now, what's the rationale being offered? Yes. Okay, yeah, so that might be the question of how can animals reproduce. It's true, but that's not the rationale being offered here. What is the person who's saying...
It's a natural thing that happens between animals.
Okay, it's a natural thing. And so if it happens naturally with animals, what's the conclusion that they're implying? It's okay for humans, right. So if animals do it, it's okay for humans to do it. Okay. Can anyone think of a question that you might ask?
Animals eat their own young.
Okay, yes, right. Some animals eat their own young, right? Would that make it normal or permissible for humans? No, that's absurd. That's right. So is the rationale that leads to it. Okay, so that you get the idea. This is taking the roof off. Now let's apply that to the topic of moral relativism. Now remember, moral relativism is the idea that what's right and wrong is not decided upon by some objective standard, but it's decided upon by you and me. I decide what's right and wrong for me. You decide what's right and wrong for you. So therefore, you can't impose your morals on me, and I can't impose my morals on you. That's moral relativism. So are there any... What question could you ask that graciously takes the roof off with this particular challenge? Yes?
So you were to go to airplanes, you would go to have a limit,
okay, so you want to build an airplane, but instead of building out of aluminum, you're suggesting to build it out of stinky socks?
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, that would be objectively a bad idea, okay, perhaps. But we also want to take the roof off. We want to show the, that would be a bad idea just from an engineering perspective. But how do we take the roof off of this rationale? What example or question could you ask that shows that the idea that morals are relative to each person is a completely absurd idea? Okay, yeah. Right. Somebody took my phone, and so therefore, that's wrong. And they'll say, well, no, it's not wrong. It might be wrong for you, but not wrong for me. Right? So that would be, that's absurd. How could it be the case that stealing is not wrong to everybody, right? The best way to do it would be to actually demonstrate that. So sometimes when this happens, and somebody says this, especially if it's an audience question, I just walk up to them and I'll just grab their phone and just walk away with it. And they're going to say, well, what are you doing? I'm like, well, I'm taking your phone. They're like, well, you can't do that. And I'll say, well, why not? You can't have it. I'm like, well, I just took it. It's mine. They're like, it's wrong. I'm like, oh, wrong. Oh, well, you might think it's wrong, but I think it's okay. So don't force your morals on me, you know, to each his own, right? Whatever floats your boat, you know? I mean, that's absurd, right? So it was one example. I mean, if right and wrong is up to you, then I can punch you in the face, and that might be wrong to you, but it's right for me. I mean, it's just absurd to think that that's how we would live. In fact, our whole culture is opposed to this idea because we have laws that say it's not true, right? That's why we make laws, because we don't think that murder or stealing is relative, right? So anyway, so that's an example, you know. People, here's an important point to realize, people can talk like moral relativism is true. They can say, oh, well, to each his own, don't force your morals on me. But they can't live consistently with that philosophy. Because as soon as someone violates one of their moral rules, all of a sudden they want that moral rule to apply to everybody. You know? So again, it's easy to talk this way, but you can't live it. And very few cultures do. Right? Now, some people will say, but Alan, but stealing, it's against the law, and that's why it's wrong. But that's completely mistaken, because actually laws It's not that it's wrong because it's against the law. Rather, it's against the law because it's wrong. In other words, the reason we have laws is because we have moral rules that have been legislated. Now, you may have heard people say, Alan, that's not true. You can't legislate morality. This is totally false. The only thing you can legislate is morality. Think about it. Why do we have a rule? Why do we have a law against stealing? Anyone know why we have a law against stealing? Yes? Well, yeah, so people won't lose all their stuff. That's true. And why is it wrong for someone to come take your stuff? Yeah, they didn't earn it. It's yours, right? So we have a moral rule that says it's wrong, it's immoral to take another person's property. So what do? We take that moral rule and we create a law that forces that moral rule down everyone's throats. We legislate morals. We legislate that morality. Why do we have laws against murder? What's that? It's not good to murder. Okay, it's true. But more specifically, what's the moral problem? Yeah? Say it again. Yeah, people have a right to live. And so we think it's immoral to kill someone without proper justification. So what do? We take that moral rule and we create a law that forces that moral rule down everyone's throats. Right? So we legislate that morality on everyone in the culture. So we legislate morals all the time. That's what every law is. It's a moral rule pushed on everybody. Okay, so what about taking the roof off with regards to religious pluralism? This is the idea that all religions are true, or the idea that, well, not just Christianity is true, any religion is true. Okay? What question could you ask that takes the roof off of this idea that all religions are basically true? Let's just take, for example, Islam. Let's say Islam and Christianity are both true. Is there any absurdity that would result if both Islam and Christianity were true at the same time? What's that? Okay, they both say, yeah. So what about specifically about Jesus? What do we believe about Jesus? Son of God, you know, one with the Father, right? So part of the Trinity. Does anybody know what Islam says about Jesus? He's a prophet. Did they say he's the Son of God? No. Does he say he's a part of the Trinity? No. In fact, they don't just say no. They vigorously reject it. There's an entire chapter in the Quran, chapter 112, that rejects the idea of the Trinity. So if all religions are basically true, that means, just with Christianity and Islam, that Jesus is the Son of God and not the Son of God at the same time. That Jesus is one with the Father and is not one with the Father at the same time. That's completely absurd. That's right. And so would the rationale that led to this absurdity can also be rejected. One time I was talking to some college students, and they said, yeah, all religions are basically true. And I said, let me ask you a question. I said, have either of you three ever met my mother? And they're like, no, we just met you today. I'm like, okay, let me ask you a question. Describe for me what you think my mother looks like. So one of them's like, well, I don't know, maybe she's 5'3", weighs 130 pounds, and has got black hair. I'm like, okay. Then I asked the second guy, what do you think my mother looks like? He's like, I don't know, 5'5", 150 pounds, brown hair. Okay, and that's the third guy. It's like, I don't know, 170 pounds, 5'7", blonde hair. I'm like, really? Blonde hair? Like, okay, whatever. I said, now let me ask you, can all three of you be correct? Can my mother be 5'3", and 5'5", and 5'7", all at the same time? No. She's only got one height. Can she weigh 130, 150, and 170 all at the same time? No, she can't. She's only got one weight. Can she have black hair, brown hair, and blonde hair at the same time? Okay, don't go with the whole thing. There's always someone who has to, like, spoil my story. Okay, I'm saying all over, all right? No, she's only got one kind of hair, right? So my mom can't be all these different things because different people have different ideas about what she's like. She's only got one height, one weight, and one hair color. And the same is true about God. Different religions have different ideas about what God is like. Some say God is personal. Some say he's not personal. Some say God has a son. Others say God doesn't have a son. Some say God is the same as the universe. Others say God is separate from the universe. Can all these religions be true? Can they all be correct about the nature of God? Can God be personal and not personal at the same time? No. Can God be the same as the universe and separate from the universe at the same time? No. So you can just go down the line and see that different religions have different ideas about God. They can't all be true because they contradict each other in fundamental ways. And that's why I say this just takes the roof off with that. Christianity might be false, but all religions cannot be true. It might be the case that Christianity is false, but it can't be the case that all religions are true. That's one thing we know. And I think one of the reasons why this whole thinking about religious pluralism and moral relativism, which are both coming from relativism, the reason why this has taken shape is because it is not politically correct in American culture today to tell people they're wrong. If you tell a person they're wrong, do you know what's the word that you're going to be called? A bigot? What's another word? Maybe racist. Bigot with an I? Idiot. You might be called an idiot. Intolerant, right? Wait a minute. You're intolerant of Muslims. You're intolerant of Buddhists. You're intolerant of whatever. You name the religion, right? And this word, intolerant, has become such like a buzzword that nobody wants to be called intolerant. And so, therefore, we got to be tolerant of every idea and everything and everybody and every behavior. The problem is that this fear is unjustified because people are confused about the definition, the true definition of tolerance. In fact, the definition has been completely reversed in the last, I don't know, probably 50 years or so. The culture, the way that culture defines tolerance today is basically agreement. If you agree with another people or person or a group, then you're labeled as tolerant of them, right? If you think homosexuality is okay, well, you're tolerant of homosexuals. And of course, that sounds really good. But this is not the true definition of tolerance. It's not the definition of tolerance if you looked it up in the dictionary. And it's not even the definition of tolerance that's been used in American culture for the last 50 years. In fact, I looked up the definition of tolerance. Here's what I found. It says this: to recognize or respect other people's beliefs and practices without sharing them. Or to bear or put up with someone or something not necessarily liked. In other words, the real definition of tolerance is disagreeing with a person, but still respecting them as an individual. Notice, the true definition of tolerance requires that you disagree with a person first before it makes any sense to tolerate them. You do not tolerate people you agree with. They're on your side. The only people you can tolerate are those people who are different than you or who oppose you. If you just simply agree with people, you are not exercising the virtue of tolerance. That's why Christians turn out to be, despite what everybody in our culture believes, Christians turn out to be some of the most tolerant people I know in culture. Why? Because we have principled opposition and disagreement with a whole bunch of ideas, yet we still respect those people with dignity and respect. That's the true definition of tolerance. We can be credited with the virtue of tolerance. The people out in the culture that say, oh yeah, no, homosexuality is okay, they're not being tolerant. They're in agreement with those people. They might say, well, yeah, we agree with them. Okay, well, don't say you're tolerant then. Because the only way you can be tolerant is if you first disagree with someone. And then and only then does it make sense to say you are tolerating them. Now, adding to that confusion is the fact that the word tolerance can be applied to three different things: persons, behaviors, and ideas. Tolerance can be applied to persons, behaviors, and ideas. So, for example, you could have tolerance of behavior. And this would mean that all behaviors are equal and everybody agrees that any behavior is morally permissible. Now, do we think that in our culture, in American culture? No, right? You can believe what you want, but there's some things that you just can't do. Murder, rape, stealing, whatever. These are not tolerated in our culture. So notice, it is totally okay in our culture to be intolerant of some behaviors, right? Nobody thinks that every behavior is okay. Well, what if you apply tolerance to ideas? This would be the concept that every idea is equal. Do we in American culture think that all ideas are equal? No, we do not. We don't think slavery as an idea is equal. We don't think that women not voting is a good idea. Men don't say anything every time. They're like, yeah, that's a good idea. It's like, no, please, sir, be quiet. Sometimes you always have that one. Anyways. What about that? The Third Reich idea, Lebensentwertes Leben, life unworthy of life. Is the idea that there are some lives that don't, some people who are don't deserving of living? Do we think that idea is equal? No. So notice, it is also appropriate to be intolerant of some ideas. And there's nothing wrong in our culture. People think it's okay to be intolerant towards some ideas. What about tolerance of persons? That would mean that all people are equal. Do we, in American culture, think that all people are equal? Yeah, in fact, the Constitution and Declaration of Independence says, yeah, all people are equal, right? Equal in value. And when we are tolerant of people, this is what we used to use the word civility or tolerance. These are synonymous words that refer to the fact that you might disagree with a person and even vigorously debate them, but you still respect them as having intrinsic value and being a valuable person. Now, here's the problem. These three categories are completely conflated and confused. Because when a Christian says, I disagree with homosexual behavior, notice we are saying we're intolerant of the behavior, but we are accused of being intolerant towards what? The person. Or if we say, well, I think Islam is false. I think this idea is false. Oh, okay, well, you're intolerant of the person who's a Muslim. So you see, we say we are opposed to some behaviors and ideas, but we're automatically then accused of being intolerant of the person because people in our culture do not make this distinction. Because the word tolerance has been completely obliterated in terms of its meaning. And this is a problem. So you have to sometimes do some education. Okay. Let me close with a final thought and we can take some questions. But here's the obvious thing. Look, Christianity teaches that there is an objective standard, that morals are not relative, that there is a God who made a perfect standard, and because of that perfect standard, every person in this room and on this planet is guilty of breaking some of those objective standards, those laws. Okay, the church, we call that sin. But basically, at the end of the day, we are guilty of committing crimes in God's jurisdiction, and His jurisdiction happens to be the entire universe. Okay? And so, because we've committed crimes, we feel guilty. And the reason we feel guilty is because we are guilty. And the solution to guilt is to be pardoned, or to at least get a pardon. And of course, that's the beauty of the gospel. God offers lawbreakers, guilty people who deserve to be punished, an opportunity to be pardoned. To be pardoned from the crimes they've committed against God. And that's where Jesus comes in, right? God says, look, I will give you an opportunity to be pardoned for the crimes you've committed so you don't have to go to spiritual jail, aka hell, so long as you accept Christ, you trust me for the pardon and transfer the ownership of your life to me. That's your free choice. You can accept the pardon and go free, or you can pay for the crimes yourself. It's up to you. And again, that's what we're faced with, an objective standard of morality, and there's only one religion that offers the pardon, and of course that's Christianity. That's why Jesus says in John 14:6, I am the way, I am the truth, and I am the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. That's Jesus in a nutshell saying religious pluralism is false. There is only one God, and let's be thankful that we've come to know that God and that we've been pardoned for the crimes we've committed against him. Okay, just a quick reminder for those of you who were not here yesterday, if you were not here and you should have one of these forms, they're perforated. I want you to pull them apart. You'll notice on one side there's the Colombo tactic. This is just a tactic. So I taught you taking the roof off. We actually have a whole series of tactics. There's a book out there called Tactics, like 8 different tactics. And this is just the first one called the Colombo tactic. It's about asking questions. Very powerful, very easy. This is for you to keep in your purse or your wallet or your man bag, whatever it is. The white card is, or the other card is for me. I want today to just be the beginning of a relationship where me and the others at Stand to Reason have a chance to mentor and to train you and the next generation. And so we kind of do that training from a distance. Every 2 months, we mail out some article, some training piece on some apologetics or theological topic or ethical issue. We cover things like stem cell research, embryonic or adult stem cell research. We talk about cloning or how we know Jesus rose bodily from the grave, or what is the evidence that macroevolution is false, or other things like that. Timely topics so that you're not caught off guard, and so that you know how to respond and or train others in your influence. And so if you want to get that, we're going to send it for free for a year, and then we'll stop sending it because we don't want to impose on you. But if you call us up and say, no, I've got this for a year, and I love it, please keep sending it, then we'll keep sending it to you. Okay? But we don't want to impose on you, so we'll only send it to you free for a year, and then afterwards, it's still free, but you got to ask for it. We just don't want to keep sending you something you don't want. So fill this out, and then there's a little book table just down the hall. Put it there in the book table, and if you fill this out, my son, who will be working the book table, will give you this free quick reference guide called Jesus, the Only Way, and there are 9 lines of reasoning from Scripture that demonstrates that Jesus is the only way to salvation. So basically, it's a refutation of religious pluralism from Scripture, because there's a lot of Christians out there, or people who cite the Bible, who argue that the Bible is pluralistic, that's open to all religions. And so this is a nice refutation of that. You can't buy this. You can only earn it, if you will, by filling out this card and turning it in. So, oh, by the way, if you want a digital copy and not a mailed paper copy, just put your email address and say, send me a digital copy, and we'll get that sent out to you. Okay? All right. Questions? Questions, comments, concerns about relativism, or really anything that
we want to emphasize that this is a time we want to give over to the youth. Okay? So the parents, let's hold up to your questions first. Okay? We want to have the youth ask questions that they didn't have a chance to do for the last 2 sessions. So any youth want to ask questions, we'll turn the mic over to you first. And any remaining time, then we turn over to the parents. Any young people? Questions even about the last 2 sessions that you have a chance to hear? Young people? Okay. What do they say? Like, speak or hold forever hold your tongue?
That sounds so final.
Like wedding, so, anyone? If you're so afraid, you can write, your questions on a little slip and then give it to the person next to you and ask your mom or your dad to ask for you. Yeah.
Or you can ask me at the break if you want as well.
Yeah. Ask one more time. No questions? You got all understood? Man, that's unbelievable. Yeah, you're right. So I'm looking at the handful of youth. Well, I'm sorry, you're so young. I thought you're youth.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. You count as youth. That's right.
Anyone?
Use oil of Olay, you might look younger.
Okay, really? Okay, parents, I know you're never ending questions. Again. All right.
Your argument on same sex marriage changed my view of it. Thank you. And I I'd like to ask you to share your opinion or possibly argument on bathroom access law. The transgender bathroom access law. What's your opinion of it or argument of it?
Well, generally, I think it's a bad idea because it puts the majority of our the women in our culture and younger girls at risk. So that concerns me. I don't disagree that there are people who actually that there are men who actually believe they are females, and I'm sympathetic to that. And I don't deny that they are incredibly distressed about their confusion, but I don't think that justifies a law that other people would abuse. And so we've seen a number of cases where people have taken advantage of such a law in order to gain access to female changing rooms and or lockers and bathrooms for nefarious purposes. So to me, it seems like there's got to be a different solution than jeopardizing the safety of the vast majority of women and younger girls. I have a video about that, by the way, on our YouTube channel, STR Videos, addressing that. I think it happened when there was a Target adopted a policy for a time, I think, that allowed that. And so there's a big outcry, and I created a video. And so if you just go to our YouTube channel, STR Videos, and you just did a search for, I think, bathroom law or something like that, or Target and bathroom law, you'll see a much fuller explanation of that. Question over here.
If a college child who has a roommate and brings in boyfriend or girlfriend to sleep in the dorm, and all other roommates think it's normal, just accept it, or it's her dorm or his dorm too, and it's just you just need to tolerate it. How are you going to
just need help? To what
tolerate?
Tolerate it.
Yeah, so you just need to accept the fact that he or she can just do it. And that college child is really bothered and think it's wrong. And how are you going to help or rebuild that college kid's life? I don't know how to. So just how to help him or her too.
So if a college student, so I'm assuming they're a Christian college student.
Mm-hmm.
They're at a dorm,
mm-hmm.
and their roommate, mm-hmm. another male, let's mm-hmm. say, so they're
yeah.
That roommate brings a girl into the dorm room. Or a boy. Oh, okay. So is it either or is it only a boy, like a same-sex kind of thing?
Either.
Either, okay, yeah. And so you're saying, what can the Christian roommate say or do? Is that your question? Or?
Yeah, and also how to help her, because or him, because he or she may be the only one that bothered, because everyone
yeah.
says, just take it.
So, I mean, okay, it would... The first question I would have is, what is the dorm's policy? Because at least when I stayed in dorms at Cal State Long Beach, there were policies against that, and I went to a secular school. Now, I don't know, maybe it's changed, but perhaps if there's a policy in place that says you can't have people spending the night and certain thing, that, I mean, that's, I think, in a lot of dorms still the case. So to me, that would be the best way to do it. Just go to the policy of the dorm and say, well, if this is the policy, I just ask you to, you know, do that. I mean, it doesn't even have to be that the other roommate is having sex
with them. I mean, just for privacy's sake, you know, right. I don't want people in my room at night when I want to have some privacy changing and whatever. So, even if there's like, well, we're not having sex. Okay, fine. I still don't want anybody in my room. I have my dorm roommate, and that's enough. I don't want somebody else at night sleeping in here, you know. So I think the first thing would be to go to the policy of the dorm, and second of all, just to ask for basic privacy and decency. I mean, I don't think either of these things even have to do with Christianity per se. And they would be totally reasonable. I think even a secular person would be quite possibly willing to accept such a request.
Well, the argument is that it's his or her dorm too. Why can't he or she bring somebody in?
Well, okay. So you could do that. So I guess then you could just relativize everything. Well, yes, it's my dorm too, so I'm going to sell narcotics in this dorm. Well, that's ridiculous. Just because it's your dorm too, it doesn't mean you have carte blanche access to do anything you want. So I agree, it is your dorm, but there's some, again, I'm almost certain there's got to be some policies in place at the dorm that say, yes, it's your dorm and you have some freedoms, but you don't have total freedom, right? You can't have a 20-person party with loud music and marijuana and, I mean, there's got to be a limit, right? So whatever that limit is, it must be in place somewhere in the school policy. I would just go to that first, and I'd start there. So that would be my approach. I don't think you even have to appeal to morality or anything. I mean, maybe it depends on the school, but chances are the school has a policy in place that's fairly enforceable. And when I was in the dorm, we had RAs who we could go to. There were other students that would help enforce those things. So there's typically things in place for that kind of thing. Yeah.
So today's message about truth and tolerance, I think, is very important for our parents, especially the Christian parents. Because I heard a lot of time our kids who grow up in the church complain that we are not tolerant to the non-believers, to the secular world. So I just want to ask you advice to the Christian parents. How we can guide our kids to build up their faith at the same time to show the tolerance we have, whether to the homosexual or whether to the other problem. So what's the principle? I know you give us some very good guidance. What is tolerance? Exactly, what is tolerance? Is there any guidance, like how we can help our teens that we? Because a lot of time they say that Christians are judgmental. That's what our kids are saying. Even though they are believers, they have a solid foundation in their belief, but they still think as we are, because there's some like gap between generations. They still think the parents more judgmental than themselves.
Yes. So there's a couple of things. First of all, relativism is inherently what's called self-refuting. Self-refuting just means it's self-contradictory. So for example, if I say to you, I cannot speak a word in English. Okay, that's a self-contradictory statement. Because what did I just say? I said I can't speak a word in English. And what language did I say it in? English. Or if I say, my brother is an only child. Okay, that's self-contradictory, right? If I say my brother, that means we're siblings. There's two of us. If I say he's the only child, that means there's one. Yeah, right, so relativism is like this. It's self-contradictory. As soon as someone makes a relativistic claim like, oh, you're being judgmental, this is a self-contradictory. Because whenever they accuse you of being judgmental, they are being judgmental towards you. And let me give you an illustration. If somebody says, well, you're being judgmental. You ask, well, what's wrong with that? They're going to say, well, it's wrong to judge other people. Okay, but guess what they just said? They said, you're wrong for judging. Meaning, they just made a judgment upon you. So, that's why I say relativism is easy to talk as though relativism were true, but it's impossible to live consistently with it, because in this case, it's inherently self-contradictory. People say, well, you shouldn't, mom and dad, you shouldn't impose your morals on other people. Really? Why not? Because it's wrong to do that. Is that your morality? Yeah. Well, then why are you imposing it on me? I mean, you can't escape it. Relativism is a contradictory system. It's a foolish, meaningless system. So the way you would demonstrate that is, again, I feel bad that I'm going to repeat myself, but to go back to what we said earlier, we need to do proper education in worldview, theology, and apologetics, okay, to the entire church and especially to young people. And when younger believers are taught this, they're less, when they're inoculated to these false ideas, they're less likely to say them back to you or be influenced by the culture that they are immersed in the world. But if we don't inoculate them, if we don't teach them relativism, if we don't teach them evolution, if we don't teach them naturalism, if we don't teach them abortion, if we don't teach them homosexuality, we got to teach them false ideas and not isolate them. Because when we isolate them, then they go off and they hear them for the first time in the wrong context and they adopt them as true. This is why, I mean, with like sex education. They'll say, well, how do you prevent kids from believing all this transgender stuff? Well, unfortunately, you have to be the first to initiate a conversation about sex and homosexuality and transgenderism. Unfortunately, that's what we got to do. And I spent, my son's now 13, but very early on, I began talking to him, in age-appropriate ways. Hey, son, what are parents? What is a marriage? There's a mother and a father. That's a marriage, I told him what is true over and over in age-appropriate ways, such that as he got older, he got to realize that. And then when he saw something that wasn't a man and a woman in marriage, he immediately recognized that as false. And so we had initiated the conversation. So his experience of it was first in the context of truth, rather than allowing, sending our kids out, saying, well, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to put that in their mind. Well, we think we're doing good, but we're only hurting them, because then they go out, they hear their friends talk about it, their friends educate them about it, the school educates them about it, and then now we're reacting, we're responding, and now it's too late. So this is why I say we got to inoculate. And again, I apologize for repeating myself, but it's just as simple as that. We got to educate, And education, see, the problem with that answer is it sounds boring. Oh, yeah, education, yeah. Oh, I know, we got to educate the church. No, yeah. It just sounds boring. It's not a, ooh, exciting answer. But unfortunately, that's the reality. You educate, you inoculate, and you don't have these problems. There's been so many studies on this where they've taken people and exposed them to false ideas, and then taken another group of people and told them that the idea was false, but not why it was false, and then had them exposed to the idea, and then took in another group and told them an idea was false, why it was true, why it was false, and that group is the group that was most inoculated from the false idea. So it's not just enough to say, son, daughter, this is wrong. Go out and know that. It's, hey, here's why people believe in evolution. Here are the reasons. Here's the evidence. Do you see why they believe it? Then let me show you what's wrong with it. Okay, that's inoculation. So they go out, and when they hear the argument, they're like, oh, yeah, I remember my mom telling me, yeah, I've heard that, yep. Yeah, I know, it's false, here's why, And they're not taken by it. But if we isolate them from these ideas, then they hear for the first time, they're like, wow, that's a good reason, yeah. Yeah, mom and dad, why are you so judgmental? What's wrong with you pastors, Now we're responding, we're like, oh, okay, look, son, look, that's not true. Yeah, it's true, that's what I heard. It's too late at that point. I mean, it's not too late, but that's the wrong time to start the education.
Do you have any
There's a book there called Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Mid-Air. And that book was written by my boss, Greg Kokel, and it's all about relativism. But there's many. There's another book called Truth Decay. And relativism is, I mean, there's so many great Christian books on relativism and dealing with it. It's the de facto philosophy of American culture. It is the predominant way of thinking in American culture. We're so saturated in it that we don't even know. It's like a fish wondering if swimming in water. Like, they don't even think about it. It just is in the everything that they breathe. And because we Christians are in it too, we drink it as well. We don't realize it, but we've been influenced by it.
So regarding education and inoculating our youth, are there any good curriculums that you're aware of that might be suitable for our youth ministry? Because I think the ones that are prevalent out there kind of dodge topics like homosexuality, purity, and things like that. And they're not comfortable topics for a lot of organizations to go into for obvious reasons. And so I think what happens is when we follow various curriculum, we kind of miss out on some of these topics. Not to say that, how to share the gospel, how to spread the gospel, lessons like that are not good. But I think that, those things come secondarily to our purity and to us first, having the moral standards to qualify as being, someone who would then go out and share the gospel.
Yeah. So my recommendation would be to look up Summit Ministries. Summit Ministries is based in Manitou Springs, Colorado, which is in southern Colorado near Colorado Springs. They do a two-week conference on worldview and apologetics. I go there seven times a summer to that campus, another four times elsewhere. And they have some of the best training in worldview and apologetics, and they've developed a curriculum that people can use. They have elementary all the way through high school. So these guys bring out the top speakers from around the country, and so they've included it to do training during this 2-week conference that happens seven times a summer. But they've taken those people and also used their education on all these different topics like worldview and film and art and relativism and homosexuality and Islam, and then integrated them into their curriculum and made it available for churches and schools to purchase. So I'd recommend that curriculum. And I'm not just saying because I go there, but they ask me to teach there all the time, and I'm telling you, they do first-rate work. It's excellent. So I'd recommend their curriculum. They certainly don't paper over any of the topics that we've discussed. Summit Ministries, I think it's summit.org maybe, I don't know. But it's based in Manitou Springs, Colorado. And if you have anyone from the ages of 14 to 22 and you want to send them there to the summer, I will be teaching there. It is the best training. My kids come with me because I often come when I teach, but when they're old enough, I'm definitely sending them there. It's just, you can't beat what they're doing there. It's amazing, So for the 14 to 22 year old, it's a 2-week conference. But, whereas a lot of conferences that I'm invited to teach, like high school camps and whatever, they'll do throughout the day, there'll be mostly fun and games and water, water skiing and water slides and whatever, hikes. And then maybe they'll have a morning devotional and an evening devotional. Okay. This Summit Ministries is reversed. It's all day teaching with two or three breaks for lunch and dinner and, some fun stuff. They'll go to the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs, or they'll go up to Pikes Peak and hike or whatever they'll do. But the majority of it is throughout 2 weeks. It's incredible. So I highly would recommend that. If you're more partial to the Georgia area, there's a similar organization called Impact 360, and they're based south of Atlanta in Pine Mountain, and they also have a similar 2-week training camp. They have a high school one, and they have a college one. I teach at a couple of those as well, and they do the same thing. I mean, the same people that teach at both, just first-rate training, worldview, apologetics, theology, and they cover all these things, you know. How messages are integrated into film and art and culture and television, and they analyze, you know, song lyrics, they do apologetics, they do scientific apologetics, they do biblical apologetics, they do history. I mean, it's just amazing. But anyways, Summit Ministries also has curriculum that they sell, so I recommend that. Although I got an email saying that maybe the plane won't take off, so we'll see. But I still have a question.
Here's your chance. Questions that you wanted to ask about the homosexuality or the same-sex marriage or tolerance. Anyone? Really? You want to close early? Really? Okay. Well, I'll schedule time to finish my 6:30, but we don't have to use up all the time. You know. Maybe then, perhaps, you will have some conversation with him, and depending on how delayed the plane is, you know, midnight.
That's right.
Yeah. Maybe then after that, you can engage with some private conversation with him. All right. Okay, so...
Have been incredible. I mean, I read all this stuff and I heard all this stuff. Not all of it, but I heard a lot of it more. But incredible blessing. Thank you, Alan. I really appreciate you. Thank you so much. Once again, this is a round of applause. Thank you very much. If you pray with me, let's bow our heads. Father in heaven, we thank you so much for just your grace over us and just allowing us to go through these three sessions with Alan, Lord. God, I just pray for transformation, Lord. Wherever we were, Father, I just pray that we would be different now, that we would be better and more honoring to you in our thoughts, in our actions. Maybe we had prejudices. Maybe we had hang-ups, Lord. Or maybe we don't know how to treat, these special people in our lives that are maybe LGBTQ. But Father, whatever the case is, you have always called us to love. You have always called us to your righteousness and your holiness through your grace in Jesus Christ. So, Lord, I thank you, Father, that you have instilled this passion of love through Jesus upon us, Lord. And, Father, I pray that we would act graciously, that we would know how to love, that we would have tolerance without making compromise, Lord. Father, we thank you for all that you do here in this church. We thank you for the body that we have. And, Father, we thank you for the glory that you give us. We love you, we thank you, we praise you, Father, for all these things in Jesus' name.